Hello everybody and welcome to this week's episode of Media Voices, bringing you all the news and the views from around the media world, and there certainly are a lot of both this week. So we're going to be talking about everything from Quartz being acquired by a Japanese media company Userbase, to bad results for the Telegraph Media Group, but some good results for the Times and Sunday Times. Before that though, I'm your host, Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
Before we get to that though, Peter, who is this week's guest?
This week, I spoke to digital storytelling consultant Corinne Podger, who is just about to start teaching digital and mobile journalism at the University of Melbourne in Australia. We spoke about her mobile journalism manual and whether the emphasis in that one is on the mobile or the journalism part. And she had the best media choices pick ever.
Very nice. Did you try to do an Australian accent then and bail out?
No, I didn't. I thought about it briefly, but I then.
Well, then, to start with, we're going to begin, as ever, with the news roundup. And Quartz, one of our Media Voices crushes, is being acquired by a Japanese media company, Userbase. The deal's reportedly worth up to $110 million, depending on how they perform financially for the rest of the year. And it's been seen as an opportunity for Quartz to then pivot towards consumer revenue as well. So it's kind of all changed there. Now, this is something that apparently has been on the cards for quite some time, with a bunch of people suggesting that Quartz has been, you know, subtly being shopped around for quite some time. But was there anything about Quartz particularly that made you think, well, you know what, these guys are going to get snapped up one day?
Well, that's brilliant. I don't know how I feel about this deal. Mm. It's just, I thought, you know, Quartz with the Atlantic or Quartz on its own, I don't know, it just seemed like a really good news, hope story.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And this is like, you know, we're potentially back in the land of corporate bullshit. So I don't know.
Yeah, to be fair to you, I don't think that the media world in general has really made up its mind about whether this is a good story or not yet. So people have pointed out that the multiple of kind of 2.5 is relatively low for when you're talking about a media acquisition. You know, when you look at a number of loss-making entities out there who've eventually gone for a fraction of what they originally kind of tried to market themselves for.
But doesn't it sound more realistic than the usual crap that we get for digital media?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, this thing's worth more than every other media company in the world just because someone decides it is. At least this seems based on something.
No, definitely. And I think that in part is based on the idea that Quartz did have that very definite audience in mind. They weren't saying we are appealing to everybody. We are going after these, you know, this huge scale, which in turn helped command those ridiculous prices. So moving on then, the Daily Beast is creating a membership program with members getting exclusive and early access to content for $100 a year. Esther, do you want to take us through what this entails?
Yeah, so I guess for those of you who don't know, the Daily Beast is an American news and opinion website that's focused on politics and pop culture. Plenty of them around, but they're kind of launching this program called The Beast Inside.
Which is a great name.
I think that's a brilliant, brilliant name. But their offering is they're going to give people who pay early access to articles and exclusive newsletters. I mean, that's fairly standard. Podcasts, long read stories. They're also going to give them the option to have their comments appear on the site because there's currently no commenting option. Mm. And they're also going to solicit opinion pieces from paying members, which is quite an interesting one.
It's an interesting way to try and galvanize your readership into actually being an active member of the community.
Kind of by interesting, do we mean mental?
Well, kind of dangling that carrot as a lure to say, hey, look, if you are active and if you do have something to say, then we'll publish it. People want that, you know, the visibility that comes with having a byline on a site like this. I'm not saying it's going to work out for them.
They have put the caveat that they will publish the best ones. So I don't think it's a kind of, you know, if you pay, you're guaranteed to be able to write whatever you want for the site. But I was sort of a bit sceptical about this because I thought, well, who's consumer-facing? Who's going to pay $100 for kind of politics and pop culture content? They've got what they believe is a hardcore fan base of 1 million readers who apparently read almost 50 pages a month. And they think that those are the ones that will be willing to pay. And they've also got really good figures in that 40% of traffic comes directly to their homepage.
That is good. So they reckon that this hardcore fan base of 1 million, they're selling it for $100 a year. That's $100 million in revenue purely from this membership program.
If they all pay.
If they all pay.
We look at this and we go, $100 a year, and we go, holy crap. Why would anyone pay $100 a year for anything? And then we go out and we buy a Starbucks 5 times a week or whatever. And that's significantly more than $100 a year. What actually is important about this, and Esther's made this point, if people are using this every single month, $100 is nothing.
Well, it's not nothing, is it? Because it's still $100.
But it's not. It actually is nothing.
Yeah, but I think that's quite a big psychological barrier.
It's less than $2 a week.
Yeah, but people buy Starbucks because it's a relatively small amount. It's something that they feel they need.
The difference here is that I can't go to Starbucks and get a Starbucks for free, whereas this I can still go to it. And yes, okay, I might get the stories on time rather than early, but it's all still free.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Okay. But I guess my real point is the user, I think it's the Times, or maybe the FT, has got this formula that they've got, which renewal rates are based around frequency of visits and the last time that someone visited. And if that's nearer in terms of date to today, then you've got a better chance of renewing them. So basically, the more often someone uses something, the more chance you've got of getting them to subscribe and renew. So if the Daily Beast has got this 1 million people that use it for a significant amount of time all the time, then they've got a pretty good shot with this.
Next up on the agenda, so it's bad results for the Telegraph Media Group as ad and circulation profits drop 9%. So their annual pre-tax profits for 2017 are 13.7 million, which is half the 27.1 million of last year. And as you'd expect, the main drop is in ads and circulation, which have both seen a 9% fall. In light of what we were talking about last week with the Evening Standard, this isn't too surprising, is it? There has been a real crunch in terms of ad and circulation spend again this year. So I think they're actually doing some quite interesting stuff, to Telegraph. They have a very good travel scheme. They have kind of a very loyal base, considering.
When Kat Wildman was talking about Snapchat and some of the stuff that they're doing, they're doing some interesting stuff, definitely.
They're making a real concerted
effort.
It's not
stuff that makes any money.
No. Yeah, that's... Oh.
In fact, if anything, what all the stuff they're doing is investment in eventually making money. So look at the number of new hires they've made around tech coverage, which obviously if you have a sort of a high-value audience like the Telegraph's, if investing in tech coverage just makes sense to you because you can then do e-commerce revenue, you can do affiliate revenue, and they are making some big plays with all their digital coverage. But for the most part, they are still so dependent on the print side, as is basically everybody.
One of the things that kind of, this is maybe just daft, but is the Telegraph today where the Guardian was 3 or 4 years ago?
I mean, I see what you mean in terms of circulation and investment. I think it's inevitably skewed by the fact that their audiences are so different. And 3 or 4 years ago, the Guardian was, making such a huge play already for, digital audiences, which I don't think the Telegraph has done to that extent yet, even compared to where the Guardian was 3 or 4 years ago.
No, I think like the Guardian have always been so ahead on the tech stuff. They were first to Instant Articles, they were first to AMP. So for me, I've seen a lot of the Guardian, not necessarily because of my political views, but because they've just been there with the tech and they've been where the younger people are.
Yeah.
I've not seen the Telegraph in the same way yet.
I don't think the Telegraph has been making investment in the kind of the minutiae, the kind of digital. So OFAN about having modular pages so that they can, everything can be repurposed for mobile. I'm sure they are doing it. I just don't know if they've been doing it to the same extent, and they certainly haven't been trumpeting it.
But one of the things they have been doing is they've set themselves a goal of trying to attract kind of 3 million registered users by the end of the year. They've got the some of the reg pages where you have to almost log in to read it. They've apparently just surpassed 2.5 million for that, which is not a bad base.
But that's registers. That's not paying.
No, but it's
what percentage of them are paying anything? Because the Telegraph's always had this digital strategy rather than a digital subscription strategy. They want to continue taking ad revenue, so they need to scale. So I just wonder where they're going with that. What is this? The guy that joined them last year, Nick Hugh. So he's been here for about a year now?
June last year.
I've got to wonder what he's thinking. Saying that, he left Yahoo, so he's probably got experience with those kind of numbers.
So the Drum have written about this, and they said that in common with other media owners, it has seen increasing numbers of readers desert its print products for online alternatives, resulting in a painful contraction of circulation figures for the Daily Telegraph, which fell further to just 376,000 copies in May. And the thing that really stuck out for me between this and the Evening Standard News is that a couple of years ago, Clay Shirky, the analyst, made the prediction that we're effectively approaching a second print revenue cliff, where advertisers do not see the circulation of print products as being worth the amount of money that they're spending on it. Now, he's specifically talking there about the US market, but I think it's probably true for the UK market too. And as we see, you know, there's not a single UK newspaper now that has a circulation above 1.5 million, and that's The Sun, which has a relatively low-value audience. So, I mean, what do we think? Is print going to have this long tail, or is print approaching the second cliff in terms of revenue generation?
I think so I come at this from a magazine point of view rather than a newspaper point of view, like, because I think they're two different issues. I think newspapers, to survive in print, newspapers are going to have to become more like magazines. It's not about news anymore, it's about features, or it's about service journalism. It's the news has got to be online, because putting news in print, when someone picks it up, you know, sort of minimum of 12 hours after the news has been on Twitter or Facebook or wherever else, it's kind of daft. So there's got to be that added value. So whether that's features or whether that's proper analysis,
here's
a story that happened yesterday, and we've spent the last 24 hours actually putting together some proper context rather than all the rumor mills that are firing about on social media.
Yeah.
So there's that reinvention thing that's got going with newspapers, and I don't see that many newspapers, so maybe it is going on, but I don't think so.
No, I don't think so either. You know, print has never been a good vector for news. It's always been, you know, the least bad alternative until digital came along. You know, it was the fastest, cheapest way of getting news out, but it no longer is.
Absolutely.
And I think you're right, most people are not pivoting to that extent. You know who is and has been for years is the Financial Times, and they're doing really well as a result.
I think eventually print is going to become a lifestyle choice.
You say that. I think it probably already is for a lot of people. Look at the just the sheer amount of confirmation bias you get on basically all the main papers at the moment. People aren't buying it for news. They're buying it to have their views reaffirmed. They're buying it, as Matt Kelly said, to have a flag to wave.
We talked about that, didn't we?
Yeah.
The Telegraph's readership is definitely older. So if you just yank the print, I don't know what I mean. There's a huge number of older people have tablets or
they
whatever.
They absolutely could not discontinue the print. They are the last paper that should ever think about discontinuing print, given the age of their readership and the like proportion of revenue that comes from print.
But they're on Snapchat.
So moving from some bad news for a UK newspaper to some relatively good news for a UK newspaper. So the Times and Sunday Times are celebrating because digital subscriptions have surged 20% to 255,000, which is now exceeding print subscriptions. Esther, you put this in and you mentioned the kind of there's a psychological effect there. So what is that?
I mean, this is really, really good. Like, you know, the Times and Sunday Times, again, they've kind of always been in that category of being kind of, you know, one of the great print brands of UK news media. But then they've also been doing, their digital subscriptions, they've been doing their paywall, they've had that kind of firm, you will pay for our stuff, pretty much since the beginning. And that is, you know, that's really paying off to have exceeded your print subscriptions. And that's growth, not print subscriptions now fallen below that level. But yeah, the Drum made the point that is a really good milestone in the sense that the publisher has now probably properly reoriented to digital. Like the Telegraph, they've also kind of got like a registered access scheme, and that's now that figure is now at 3.75 million registered access users to kind of receive these complimentary articles every week from the title. So I mean, the scale here is pretty impressive for a UK title.
Yeah, no, absolutely, Peter. You recently wrote about paid content. So for a report, so is this in line with what they were projecting? Is this kind of very much their strategy? And how does this compare to the wider market?
Well, yeah, that's absolutely what they're after. The idea of growing that subscription base has been at the root of what they've done, like Esther says, from day one. And they weathered some massive, massive storms. You know, they had that infamous traffic collapse in 2011, I think it was, when they introduced the paywall in the first place. And the traffic went down 90% when that came in. And they've stuck with it, which, you've, you know, regardless of who actually owns those newspapers that we won't talk about, they've been very, very firm on what they're doing. Interestingly, how they've done this is a little bit of a shift, because it used to be that you got nothing for nothing with the Times and Sunday Times, but they introduced it, but they introduced a heavily discounted trial scheme where you can get access for £1 for, I think it's for 4 weeks or maybe 3 months for the Times. And I think that's driven a lot of their growth. A newspaper subscription or any kind of paid content subscription is so intangible. What am I buying? I don't know what I'm buying.
Mm.
So by giving people access one way or another, they're allowing people to kick the tires. They're allowing people to find out what's going on. People like the New Statesman or whoever, the metered access allows people to test the quality of the content. But if you've got a hard, hard paywall like the Times had, they can't figure it out. So the only way to do it and to keep that idea of paying front of mind is to give them a discounted paid access. And I think the Times and the Sunday Times has done that really, really well.
Moving on then, this week I went to the launch of the Reuters Institute's latest report into how European media are covering Brexit. Most of the stats in the report are as depressing as you'd expect, but there are some really interesting implications in there about how an entire nation can effectively have its news agenda dictated by a single issue or event, while the nations nearest to it geographically barely report on it at all. We talk about trying to get outside the bubble, but in the UK we are all so in this Brexit bubble, and unfortunately it doesn't seem like we're getting out anytime soon.
So this week I've been reading a piece on Digiday about how The Guardian finds less polished video more effective than professionally produced ones on Instagram stories. This kind of actually bugged me a bit. It made me quite uncomfortable that publishers would consider swapping quality for improved reach. Because I firmly believe that if your brand stands for quality, then quality is what makes you authentic. I don't really understand why people would be converted to paying subscribers through video from a news brand that looks a bit amateurish. But I just wanted to do a shout out to Tom Whitwell for a bit of kind of insight on that on Twitter from an agency point of view. So it's an interesting read. I just don't necessarily agree with it.
This week I read Tell Me More from the mighty, mighty Neiman Lab. Canada's Globe and Mail is testing a new feature, expandable in-article explainers called Globe Primers. It gives readers background context on stories, which in this time of misinformation, not fake news people.
Thank you.
In this time of misinformation, that has to be a good move. They say, as a news organisation, it's perhaps an opportunity for us to be helping people fill, and they're talking about filling the gaps in their knowledge, without forcing them to go to Wikipedia or start Googling things, just to get the background they need on a story. I think it's a really interesting trial. I think there's a lot of scope for this. This week, I had a great conversation with digital storytelling consultant Corinne Podger, all the way down in Australia. She's got an amazing CV. She's worked for Reuters and the BBC. She's worked in the States, Australia, the UK. We talked about the Pacific Islands at one point. But I started by asking her, how did she get to where she is now?
Well, I've been working in various aspects of journalism since I was 19. I trained in newspapers back in the mid-90s and then took a bit of time working in radio. The first, I guess, non-print format was radio. I did a year working in the United States on a socioeconomic development project in an African-American rural community. And my role there was partly producing content and partly training people. So that was when I was about 25. And although I then went on to work in very conventional media roles in London, working with the BBC World Service and a bit of time with a newspaper, Cambridge Evening News, I was intrigued by that experience of training. If we fast forward to 2007, I'd been working at the BBC World Service for about 11 years at that point, and I was very keen to add television, online, and social to what I was doing. And I realized that the way to achieve that was to work at a smaller media organization. So I applied to join Radio Australia, which is part of the ABC. It's the international broadcaster for the ABC, and it's twinned with Australia Network Television, and it's got a huge online presence and social platforms. And it was a very different newsroom. It was 65 people as opposed to in excess of 200 odd at World Service. Everyone did a bit of everything. So that was really an in into, I guess, digital proper, right? As in everything was digital. The TV editing was digital. The output was digital. The radio station was output on digital. All the editing systems were digital. And, of course, we were on social. So, you know, I had moved from print and then tape and then the beginnings of digital at BBC to something that was completely digital. And the other thing that happened during that time was becoming aware of how journalism is done and the challenges to being a journalist in developing countries, because part of the audience for Radio Australia is the Pacific Islands. There are some tertiary providers in that part of the world, but nothing like the journalism university system that we have here in Australia. We've got more than 11 journalism schools that you can do your studies at, and there are very few in the Pacific. And then on top of that, you know, the kind of pressures that are on journalism are on journalists are different in those environments. You know, some Pacific countries are run by, you know, Fiji is run by a military commander. Tonga is a monarchy. You know, there are the American Pacific Islands, which right. have varying relationships with the United States government and so on. So I wanted to work in development, and I took some time in 2012 to go over to London, took a career break from the ABC to scope out the media development sector because that's where it's headquartered, and met with people from the sector to say, listen, I'm really interested in working with you. And I was offered a job at Thomson Reuters Foundation. So that was my first role in the media development space. And I've been training journalists ever since. That's since the beginning of 2013.
So if you look at a sort of headline for what you do, you know, your Twitter bio says you're a digital storytelling consultant or trainer. What makes digital storytelling different from other types of storytelling?
It's perhaps easier if you reverse engineer it. The reason I call myself a digital storytelling consultant or educator as opposed to a digital journalism educator is because everybody is a publisher now. So anybody anywhere can go straight to Twitter, to Facebook, to Instagram, to YouTube. They can start their own websites. You know, they can effectively publish and to a certain degree be subject to publishing law. But let's leave that to one side. So the recipients of, or the potential recipients of training are any of those communities of which journalists are a subset. So that's why I call myself what I am, because I find that the demand for this kind of training comes equally from NGOs, from charities, from government organizations, and from business as it does from media outlets. To address your second question, what makes digital storytelling different from traditional storytelling? It's different and it's not different, okay? So a good story is a good story, right? And I guess the challenge of digital is that it's much faster. The deadlines are different to a newspaper deadline, let's say, of once a day. You know, Twitter is, you need to be there in seconds to be the first person. But the fundamentals of what makes a good story are still common. And again, when one goes back to the idea of capacity strengthening and training, people who don't come from a journalism background often need professional support in that, as well as how do you produce this from a technical point of view.
So in that sense, you're still teaching, I guess, what we might have called in the past sort of first principles of storytelling, but you're just giving it a context, a digital context.
Yes, I think that's a fair assessment in my mind, and perhaps I'm one of these people that tends to compartmentalize things just to make it easier to teach them. So to me, there are the skills around what makes a good story and what is expected of people who are working in the media specifically when it comes to transparency, editorial standards, fairness, lack of bias, and being aware of and obedient to media law in your country, so that those, I suppose, foundational skills that are part of all journalism. And then there are the technical skills that pertain to different aspects of the digital space, which look very different if you're working in digital television, digital radio, digital online, you know, web first, or if you're working in an area that supports those spaces, emerging spaces like coding, for example, or data journalism, or user experience advisors. Those kinds of people are also increasingly in newsrooms. And while journalism academia doesn't necessarily cover those skill sets, what we do try, I think increasingly the academic community tries to be responsive to the needs of journalists who are going to have to work with those kinds of job types, so that those relationships can be managed effectively in newsrooms.
So one of your personal focuses, I guess something that's developed over the last few years, is mobile journalism.
Mm-hmm.
And you wrote the Mobile Journalism Manual. How did that come about? How do you actually define mobile journalism?
So the project to create the Mobile Journalism Manual was an idea from the German government-funded development agency Konrad Adenauer Stiftung, which has one of its many offices is in Singapore. And they had earmarked funding to run a mobile journalism hackathon to bring 8 journalists from Asian countries together, with the support of a trainer, which was myself, and an editor in the form of Astrid Saraji, who's based in the CAS Berlin office, all together to Thailand to, first of all, train these 8 journalists so that they could go back and be learning champions in their newsrooms, and secondly, to produce this manual. So that's how the manual came about. And how I was brought on was that I was approached as a trainer and author to say, would you be interested in this project? And I was very interested in it because most of the mobile journalism training resources that were available, let's say up until January this year, were either hard copy books or they were online courses that people had to pay for. And there was a gap, I felt, for something that was introductory and free.
Yeah.
It doesn't, I don't think, cover everything that one needs to know. And in fact, I'm working at the moment with CAS to develop newsroom training that uses the manual as a resource, but then digs into the specifics of what people need to do in their jobs. But what it does serve as is a really solid overview of apps, equipment, how to approach editing, how to approach filming, how to think about social versus traditional formats in a way that will get someone across the genre fairly quickly.
In that sense, mobile journalism is, you've put this manual, a wrapper, if you like, round mobile journalism, but how do you actually define mobile journalism? What makes it different? What makes it, you know, different from ordinary journalism?
My personal view is that mobile journalism has at its heart smartphones. And right. The reason that I think that is the smartphone is something that you do have with you all the time. Now, I know lots of journalists. I've worked as a journalist myself. I continue to occasionally work as a journalist. I do not always have my DSLR with me. I don't always have my beautiful professional microphones with me.
Yeah.
I am in the habit of carrying a couple of clip mics in my backpack, and I always have my smartphone. So it is the camera and it is the recording device and it is the video capture device that you have with you all the time. So that's one thing. Second, you can edit the content and distribute it direct from your phone. And the third thing, which I find terribly exciting, and I really think we're still getting our heads around this as a sector, you know, mobile journalism trainers and thinkers, the audience has one, right? Mm. And that opens up you know, new avenues of content production and commentary and interaction and conversation and dialogue with not just the communities that we cover as audience, but the communities that we cover as participants in their own storytelling. And that to me is revolutionary. That changes everything about what we do, or it has the potential to.
In that sense, if every journalist's got a smartphone, does that make every journalist a mobile journalist?
Yes, absolutely. My view on this is, first of all, every journalist is a mobile journalist. If they have a smartphone, they're using it for some aspect of their work, even if it's to use it to make phone calls, because let's remember that it is a phone. They'll be using it to check their email. They'll be using it to look at what the weather's like. They'll be looking at the latest headlines. So they'll be using it to consume. In other words, what we used to refer to at the BBC as reading in, right? They'll be getting across the news agenda wherever and whenever they do that for their jobs. There's a subset of journalists that are then using the device for content production. That includes taking photographs. It might include recording interviews for transcript. It might include recording interviews for podcasts or for radio. And then we have another group of journalists who are using it to record video. Then we have a community of journalists, and it's a smaller group that are using the phones to record and edit on the phones, whether it's for radio, podcasts, or video. That is a small subset of the larger community of journalists that I would regard as mobile journalists. What I would say is that I don't believe that everybody who has a smartphone is a journalist.
Mm.
I have very strong views about that, because journalism is a profession. It involves a certain amount of training, as we were talking about earlier, and foundational skills in fair reporting, balance, copyright understanding, and being also subject to a set of laws in most countries. So it's a job that has some legal protections and some legal responsibilities. And people who are journalists have a particular way of approaching storytelling. So I would say that people who are producing content with a smartphone are content producers. Are they storytellers? Perhaps. Are they journalists? No, they're not.
I think that's really interesting. The idea that when I personally say the phrase mobile journalist, I focus on the mobile part of that. And actually what you're saying is the journalist part is the most important part. The other part is a facilitator, if you like.
Well, of course. I mean, we have, as a profession, we have always define somebody by the journalism that they do, not necessarily by the device they use to produce it. So we don't say, you know, in the 1960s, we didn't say, oh, this person is a typewriter journalist. You know, we don't refer to that person as a microphone journalist, right? They work in a newspaper or they work at a radio station. So I don't see a reason why one should define mobile journalist in a different way. It's a device that allows you to do your job.
But do you recognise that when you go into organisations that they're very focused on the technology or on the devices rather than what's ultimately the outcomes?
I think the way most newsrooms are trying to respond to these devices and think about these devices is actually from the other angle, which is thinking, how do we build content that's generated on a mobile device into our existing systems and workflow? In print, that's fairly straightforward, obviously, because you'll be filing content as text. If it's a photograph, then you need to be capturing it in a format that is the right resolution and the right crop to fit your website or your social platforms. When you're working in radio, it's very simple. Most radio output is .wav or .mp3 at a pinch. You can get away with mp3 often. We all know what MP3s are. They're just compressed versions of audio files. And smartphones have been good enough to record for radio since for about 10 years. I think it's the iPhone 3SE, something like that, 3G. Anyway, one of those early iPhone 3s was able to do it. Where you have the greatest challenge is in television, and that's because most smartphones, the native camera on most smartphones, films at 30 frames a second. And that's perfect if you're working in a country that is on the NTSC system, like the United States. It's not so great if you're on a country that's you're in a country that's on the PAL system, which needs the output to be at 25 frames a second. Now, there are ways around that. There are apps that will film in 25 to 50 frames a second and output video at 25 frames a second, but you need to know what those are and you need to know how to use them. And so that's the, I guess, demystifying that I focus on when I'm working with journalists is to say, first of all, is your content going on television, yes or no? If it's a yes, then it's a more technical conversation. If it's a no, then really we just need to know about resolution, compression, size, etc., which is a far simpler question to answer.
And do people get their head around that sort of the kind of technology of that reasonably quickly?
Well, I guess it depends on who's training them.
Yeah.
I mean, I have worked in television, but most television journalists themselves don't need to understand frame rate, yeah, because they will pick up a camera and go, and they don't need to know that it films at 25 frames a second. They just know that you take it out of the cupboard, you book it out, you take it on a job, you bring it back, you submit your content, and it will go to air. So I found when I was starting out as a trainer and trying to really get my head around these questions that I was being asked myself, that consultations I was having with video journalists weren't getting me terribly far. And I wound up having to build those parts of my training courses by talking to television broadcast operators at stations that were using Mojo. And that's a very small community of people. But then you need to be able to turn that into a concept that a trainee can understand. And, you know, frame rate is literally, I mean, this is my analogy, frame rate is literally the number of times per second that your camera is sampling what it's seeing. In some countries, it will sample it 30 times a second, and in other countries, it'll sample it 25 times a second, you know, if you're to produce content that will broadcast on your TV stations. It's not rocket science, but it's learning it for the first time, I think, makes it unfamiliar. But, yeah, I mean, we are so used to disruption, journalists, you know, of all of the professions. Something new happens every week. So, actually, absolutely, I think most people are more digitally agile if they allow themselves to be than we'd think.
It's part of the training that you end up doing about attitude, you know, that attitude to change as much as anything.
The core thing for me with training is to get across a concept of a digital mindset. Casey Neistat was writing about this on, I think it was on Twitter this week, that once you've got your content, it's not what you, you know, it's not the content that you have, it's what you do with it once you have it.
Yeah.
And so what I'm very much at pains to emphasize with the people that I'm teaching is your audio file is not an audio file. It is a .mp3. That means you can dump it into a video editing program and chuck a picture over the top of it and suddenly you've turned radio into a video. You can take an image, and it's not an image, it's not a photo, it's a JPEG or it's a .png file. And that means that you can put it into, again, into a video. You can animate it. You can put a double exposure over it. You can put text on it. You can frame it in a way that will look good on a mobile phone at 9x16, or you can stick it on Instagram at square, or you can put it on, you know, a website as a landscape, which is 16x9. Everything that you acquire should be thought about in that way. And once people start to think like that, then the smartphone becomes a really sensible tool to do a lot of that reversioning. Yeah. And also they start to see themselves as multi-platform producers because they can see a way forward to do it.
We always ask people, what was the last piece of media that really made an impact on them? It could be a podcast or a book or a magazine article, or we've even had, recently we had a Twitter thread. So is there anything that's really got to you recently?
So the piece of content that I have found the most exciting over the past, let's say, 7 months, because it still sticks with me and I still it's a must-see for my trainees, is a Twitter thread by a reporter called Gabrielle Bluestone, who's an editor at Vice. And she put together this extraordinary Twitter thread. When was this? The 1st of November 2007, which was looking at the Russian indictments and, you know, relationship with the DA in the US and so on. Anyway, it set to the lyrics of Atlantic City by Bruce Springsteen. So I kid you not. So every single line of the Twitter thread is a line from the lyrics. Well, they blew up the chicken man in Philly last night and they blew up his house too, down on the boardwalk. They're getting ready for a fight, going to see what them racket boys can do. Now there's trouble busting in from out of state and the DA can't get no relief. Going to be a rumble out on the promenade and the gambling commission's hanging on by the skin of its teeth. Everything dies, baby, that's a fact, but maybe everything that dies someday comes back. Put your makeup on, fix your hair up pretty and meet me tonight in Atlantic City. And it's several verses, and it is just phenomenal. There's a reference there to Trump in Atlantic City, the lessons behind the demise of his casino empire, how Donald Trump shifted kids' cancer charity money into his business, Deutsche Bank in bind over how to modify $300 million Trump debt, and so on. That is just gold. It merges the very best of storytelling with the very best of journalism and an absolute slayer approach to platform-specific storytelling on Twitter. So I'll send you the link and everyone can enjoy that. Yeah, I recommend reading it while you have Atlantic City playing on YouTube.
Thanks very much for listening again this week, everybody. As we mentioned last week, we've got some huge news. We are going to be traveling north to Edinburgh for the best magazine conference in the world. That's MagFest. We're going to be doing an hour-long discussion on a topic that we've decided, but we're not going to tell you quite yet. And we're going to be getting comment from other luminaries of the magazine world who are going to be there. So we're going to be joining people like Shortlist's Mike Suter, Radio Times' Mark Frith, and Twitter's Joanna Geary to do this very first Media Voices Live and an accompanying podcasting masterclass, where we'll tell you everything that we've learned about how to do and market and produce a podcast over the past 2 years. So you can get over to magfest.co.uk and book now if you're at all interested in seeing us perform live.
It's only £160.
And do remember that you can always go to voices.media to sign up to our newsletter, which has some exclusive content that you won't get within the podcast, and also to check out our archive of past podcasts with such guests as loads of people. Or you can keep abreast with everything that we're doing by going to our Twitter page at Media Voices Pod. Until next week, thanks very much for listening, and goodbye.
Thank you, bye.